This is Tate. Talking about not having seen any family members' private parts while you were growing up and then dating Jack.
So, yeah, and even at that age, so 18, 19, 20, I still I mean, I was just never subject to a naked man. Of course, in the barrack block, I did get to see lots of naked women. So, and I was very, very, very shy and sort of, I guess, inhibited. So therefore, if I took a shower, I sort of looked out to see if anybody was there, or I'd hang my towel outside so that I could reach out and get the towel, dry myself off while the curtain was still closed. If you took a bath, that was different because you were in the barrack block, you were in a inside of a stall, so you they maybe have 10 tubs in the barrack block, and all of them were in behind stalls. So you went in the stall much the same as you go into a bathroom stall in restaurants or wherever, and you sort of could lock the door behind you if you wish, and you were totally private when you were taking a bath. But when you were taking a shower, if you were taking a shower, it wasn't private, so it was just row after row after row. So, you know, and throughout my whole time in the Air Force, I was my whole time in the Air Force, I was like that. I wasn't the only one. You know, there were others. And then there were the ones who just didn't care, you know. And I thought, well, okay, it's the way you want to be, but it's just not something that I was used to. Mm-hmm. So, to date, at 57 and a half years of age, I have still not, for all intents and purposes, as far as sexual relations with sexual intercourse with a man, I have never had sexual intercourse with a man. But I know what they do when they do it.
And you know that they don't need the blue cornflakes.
Cornflakes in the blue box.
So to backtrack a little from your Air Force days, I was wondering how you and Ruth got together. Who made the first move? What was
she
the
did.
Situation?
Okay. Okay. I was working, and I had to be on the last bus every night to go home to the pier. We lived in the pier. It was about 4 miles away, because I worked at the Diana Suites restaurant in town, in Sydney. And so I worked a split shift. I worked from 11 until in the morning, 11 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon, and then 5 until midnight. That was my shift, 6 days a week. And so Dad was very, very strict with us. We had never, Dad never ever laid a hand on us. Neither did Mom. I guess we were brought up that we really were supposed to respect them, our parents or our grandparents, our elders. So it wasn't necessary to, like when Dad said, you have to come home, be on that last bus, you just did it. There was no question. It wasn't the reason to question it until, I mean, here I am, I'm working, bringing home money, And somebody invited me to a party and he told me I couldn't go. Well, that kind of rubbed me the wrong way. So that happened once, and I missed out on a party, a great party apparently. So the next party, I phoned home, said that, now this wasn't a party with boys, and I probably could have helped my cause if I said they were all Protestants. I just said, it's just the girls. There's nobody else. I said, all the girls who live in New Waterford, Glace Bay, New Victoria, the surrounding towns that were like anywhere from 10 to 15 miles away or even 20 miles away, those girls all stayed at the rooming house. And so it was somebody's birthday. So they invited me to go to this birthday. But it was like a pajama party is basically what I was going to. After work now, you know, I mean, feature that we're not getting off until midnight. We could walk. It was 5 minutes to their place. And there were several of them, maybe seven altogether. Maybe seven, possibly nine, who stayed in this rooming house. It was a big three-story sort of a tenement house. One of the bedrooms was quite big. It had two double beds in it and a single bed. So five girls stayed in that one room to save money. They certainly didn't mind sleeping with one another. You had the single bed. So, anyway, I phoned home and I told Dad that I was going to this party. He said, no, you'd be on that last bus. And for the first time in my life, I didn't do what he said. I hung up and I told him, I said, I'm not coming home, Dad. I'm going to this party. There's nothing wrong with it. There's only girls. It's only the girls that I work with. One of them is having a birthday, and I'm going to go there and I'm going to sleep overnight, and that's it. He said, be on that last bus. And I said, no. So I hung up. And I really had some pangs of guilt, you know, because I'd never, ever done that to my dad. And I thought, my dad was a real worrywart, and I thought, he's not going to sleep the whole night. He's going to be up pacing that floor wondering where I am. I knew exactly what he'd do. So I had these pangs of guilt, but I went anyway. The thought of a good time was far outweighed the pangs of guilt. Party, party. So off I went to this party. And somebody had booze. Rum. The demon rum. Yeah. And I was still a pretty tender age. And so I hadn't had any rum or anything like that before. So, rum and coke. Sure thing. Well, I started drinking the rum and coke, and they were all drinking the rum and coke. And then somebody was hungry about 3 o'clock in the morning. There was an all-night diner just down on the Esplanade. And we were right on the corner of the Esplanade. So somebody said, oh, let's go over to the Chickadee. So, oh yeah, I was all for that. We're all going to go over and get a hamburger. Now we're going to get waited on. We're all, you know, waitresses. We sling ash for a living. Now we're going to sit down and have somebody sling ash to us. So Ruth said, I don't feel like going. Why don't you stay here with me? Let the girls bring us back a hamburger. Well, this was putting a cramp to me. I wanted to go. And I didn't know. I mean, I'd just come back from the washroom, so I didn't know if she'd already asked anybody else to stay with her, but I thought, oh, God. a nice day here, but I can't leave her, let her stay on her own. I don't know why I couldn't, but I just felt I couldn't. So I stayed. Off they went. So I was drinking this rum, and I was feeling, started in no, you know, in no time at all, I started feeling pretty good. And we were both on the on one of the double beds, not on her single bed, but on one of the double beds. So I was kind of laying back there, and, you know, as the world turns. And she was laying next to me, and then all of a sudden she sort of lifted her up, herself up on one arm and sort of leaned over, and her face was just right next to mine. And she announced that she was going to kiss me. And being the smartass that I was, I said, "So what are you waiting for?" Well, she kissed me. Oh, my gosh. This is all right. It's never happened when I kissed that boy. Or that boy kissed me. You know? Oh, shit. It didn't taste good like this, you know what I mean? Like, oh my God, all these little things started waking up inside of me. And I thought, oh my God. So we had this little sort of necking session, and yes, I guess it was called then. Yeah, so we had this necking session, and then we heard the girls coming back. And so when they came in, we sat up and had our hamburgers, and they had decided that they weren't all going to stay over there and eat their hamburgers. They were going to bring it all back, so that's why they were back so soon. So they all came back, and so Ruth and I were still, we were sort of sitting at the side, on the side of this double bed. And so then it came time for us to, you know, because we've all got to go to work at 11 o'clock. So we decided we'd better get some shut-eye. And so, obviously, I was asleep in this bed, you know, in this double bed, because somebody wasn't there that, you know, whoever was sharing this particular bed. It had been determined earlier that I was to get this. I was asleep in this bed with whoever the other occupant of that bed normally was, because one of the other girls was away or something. That's fine. So then Ruth kind of laid back like she was going to fall asleep, or she was falling asleep. And the one whom I should have been sleeping with, she said to, she kind of yelled over to Ruth and said, you know, "You stay in that bed. Stay in my bed. I'll sleep in your bed tonight." That wasn't a big deal. So there we were. Then Ruth was all over me. She was kissing me, and oh my God, I didn't know what to think. And I mean, I wanted her to do this, but I didn't want three other people in the room with us. Mm-hmm. So I was sure that they could hear us. Because my heart was pounding so much that I'm sure they could have heard it across the room. You know, whatever else was pounding. You know, like, throb. I was sure that they, oh my God, what a position to be in. Oh, jeez. Finally, we fell asleep. And the thing is, you know, she started at one point. She started running her hands all over my body, of course we wore pajamas, right? And she put her hand up underneath my pajama top and started playing with my breasts, and oh.
And you were enjoying this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I didn't realize that, you know, there was so much pleasure to be had. And like I said earlier, I mean, it was nothing compared to what I found out later on. But for them, it certainly was, you know, I was quite responsive to her and what she was doing, and I didn't want her to stop other than I was sure that they could hear us, you know, and I just, I would have been mortified, I mean, because what we're doing here, I mean, I'd heard of two women doing that, there are two girls. And the next morning, we went off to breakfast. And I get up and went to the washroom, and all of a sudden there was a tap-tap. It was one of these single little washrooms, you know, and tap-tap-tap on the door. And, you know, I mean, it was nothing for two girls to go off to the washroom together, you know. One's sort of sitting on the toilet and the other one's sitting on the sink, yakking to one another. One's putting her lipstick on or whatever. So tap, tap, tap. So open the door. And here it was Ruth. She came in and closed the door and locked it. And she said, "Do you remember what we did last night?" So all of a sudden, you know, I got on the aggressive side. Not aggressive, but, well, of course I remember. So I took her in my arms and kissed her. I said, "This is what we did." Uh-huh. So it just we started to see one another just like we were dating, like a boy and a girl were dating, you know. And we decided that we wanted to go away. We wanted to live together, but we couldn't do that in Sydney, Nova Scotia. So we saved up our money, and now I had a sister. My sister was now married and living in Cambridge, or Gulf, Ontario, and my aunt was there, and I had both my brothers up there as well. You know, I was the oldest one left at home. So obviously, I was going to head for Gulf, Ontario. We were going to head for Gold. So we stayed with my sister for a little while, and then we stayed with my aunt for a little while. And when I say a little while, I'm talking about maybe 6 months or so. And with each of them. So we were in Gold for at least a year. And then we decided we wanted to go to the big city of Toronto. So we moved to Toronto. Both got jobs. We had a little sort of a bed sitting room. And so we were on our own. We were now like a married couple.
And you were somewhere around 16 or 17 by this point?
Yep. Yeah, 16, 17. Hmm. So we were sort of like a married couple, and we did things together, and, you know, I went off to work, she went off to work, and we had, before we left Galt, we had bought a car together. I had to lie about my age because I wasn't old enough to have a driver license, so that was okay. We bought the car before we got our licenses, because I just couldn't think that anybody would want to teach us to drive on their car. So we bought a car. Then I'd asked somebody to teach us to drive. So we had our transportation and everything, and So when we're in Toronto, we, for all intents and purposes, we were like a married couple. But we didn't know any other women you know, who were together as a couple. So we didn't know any lesbians or gay men. And we moved probably 3 or 4 times. And we, by the last time we moved, it was getting into the latter part of our relationship. And by then, she became very, very suspicious of who I might see, you know, if I didn't come home right away from work and that type of thing. She felt that I was seeing somebody. And then she went out. She started going out in the evenings and then coming home usually with a girl. I have no idea where she went to pick him up. And she didn't bring a lot of them home, but she brought several home. And they were all very much like she was kind of heavy into the bottle at that time. And they were too. And I wasn't. And I didn't drink, but I would have like a rum and coke and maybe 2, and then that was it. But that wasn't enough for her. And then it started that, you know, I'd be sound asleep and all of a sudden I'd get a fist right in the pit of my stomach. You know, that's how I'd wake up. And there were times that she accused me of, you know, being with somebody that I work with, somebody my age who was single. And there was one girl in particular, Penny. She was a young Greek girl. It was a Greek restaurant that I worked in. And she and I sort of hit it off and we had a lot of fun together. So I guess I would mention Penny every now and then. So she became quite jealous over Penny, and of course there was nothing. I never even entered my mind about, you know, Penny and I. Penny was promised. You know, that was part of, you know, why she was in Canada and Toronto, was because she was, you know, her parents more or less sold her. So she was, it just never entered my mind. But anyway, she became very jealous over Penny and anybody else that I might talk about. So it, you know, it just got from bad to worse, and you know, started happening more frequently. And there were times that, you know, if she really hung over or something like that, there was a couple of times that she actually took a knife to my throat and threatened that she was going to ram it right through my throat if I didn't tell her the truth. You know. But you know what, Karen? Those were not the things that scared me. You know what scared me? She threatened to tell my parents what we did and were doing. And I thought, oh my God, this will kill my dad. He knows that I'm with Ruth in that way. I mean, I couldn't have that happen. So under the threat of that, that was the thing that kept me with her as long as I did. Finally, there was one night she came home and she had, I even remember the person's name, her name was Terry. So she brought this person, she'd brought Terry home a few times, but she brought her home this one night. And all of a sudden, I got both of their fists in the pit of my stomach while I was sort of sleeping on my back. And it caused me to almost regurgitate. And I guess I just had enough. So I got up and sort of caught my wind type thing. I looked at the two of them, and they were both had been drinking, and I just took one by the side of the head and the other one by the side of the head, like so and so, and I knocked their heads together. And they went, just fell to the floor, you know, thong. I said, I've had enough of this. Boom. And they fell to the floor. And I said, leave me alone. I don't want you to ever do that to me again. And, you know, I've done nothing to you. I've done nothing wrong. You shouldn't do that to me. And all of a sudden, the door kicked open, and Mrs. Donaldson, she was our landlady, and she was there with her cane, and she pointed the cane, just shook the cane, and she said to the two of them, you get out of my house right now, right this minute, and don't you ever come back, and you only come back to get your clothes, she said to Ruth. You come back tomorrow, when you're sober. Get your clothes. Now get out of here now. So she sort of, and they were saying, oh, they were hurting, you know, and so she said, get out of here. So she kicked them out. And then she came in, you know, I just stood there. I mean, I couldn't believe that, you know, what she was doing. She was ordering them out and everything. Then she came in and she said, are you okay, dearie? Yes, I am. Well, you come downstairs with me. So I went downstairs and she cracked open a couple of bottles of beer. She said, here, you need this, dear. So she poured the beers for us and she said, now it's about time you took this into your own hands type thing. It's about time you did something. I said, well, what do you mean? She said, dearie, you must think that I am rather naive. I know everything that goes on in this house. And she said, I know. Every time they came home, that Ruth came home and brought somebody home with her, I could hear the ruckus upstairs, and I knew that they were always beating up on you. She said, well, when I heard them hitting the floor, she said, I knew you finally decided to defend yourself. So she said, so that's it. And it was that morning, as I was driving to work, that I passed 25 St. Clair Avenue East. And there was a sandwich board outside saying, join the RCAF. And I almost did a U-turn, and I parked the car, and I went in and said I wanted to join the RCAF. So I had to have at least a grade 8 education. No problem. I've got grade 9. I'm well educated. You had to be 18. Yes. I qualify there as well. Okay. And so you have to pass all these tests, written tests, mind tests, interviews, and medical. No problem. Well, I was supposed to get to work, I don't know, let's say I had to be there for 11. And I was going in early that day for whatever reason. But anyway, I phoned the boss and said I was sick. And I went through all the tests and everything. And by about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was being sworn in to the Royal Canadian Air Force. And this woman officer on the other side of the desk extended her hand forward and said, welcome to the RCAF. And about 3 months after that, I actually went to St. John, Quebec and started my basic training. But the problem, when I got home that night, of course, Ruth waited until I got home before she came in to get her clothes, because Mrs. Donaldson had told her, nope, you're not staying here anymore. So she begged me, you know, could I move out of there, and couldn't we go somewhere else and get another place together? And she wouldn't do that anymore. But I said, that's what you said all the other times, that you wouldn't do it anymore. You just kept saying, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know what I was doing and all of that. So I said, I joined the Royal Canadian Air Force. And this just sort of blew her mind. You what? I said, yeah, I'm leaving, I think in 2 months.
You were just telling me about announcing to Ruth that you had joined the Air Force. And
right.
Yes. What was her response to that, apart from, you did what?
Apart from shock? Pure shock? And disappointment, and like, how could you do this to me? How could you? You can't leave me. Well, I can't take you with me. And I'm not going to take you with me. I don't want to take you with me. So she tried to beg me to change my mind, and I said, no, I can't do that now. Sorry. I've signed on the dotted line. I've got, you know, the handshake and the whole bit. I'm now a member of the Royal Canadian Air Force. I owe them the next 3 years of my life. Anyway, she was just not happy about it. And so she was living with this terrier, whomever. And Josh, she was living with that person, but there wasn't supposed to be anything going on. They're just friends, et cetera, et cetera. And I continued to live at Mrs. Donaldson's place. I refused to move. I think, but, you know, I thought, oh, what the hell, you know. Then it became sort of a safe sanctuary for me, because she was not allowed in there. She was probably afraid of Mrs. Donaldson's cane. So I continued to try and be friends with her. Because back in Nova Scotia, her family and my family, even though she lived, her family lived some 13 to 15 miles away from my family, they had, because of our friendship, they had been introduced to one another. So they both families had an interest in what happened to both of us. Mm-hmm. So she did try to stop me from going to the Air Force by reminding me one more time that she was going to tell my parents. And I suppose, with 18 years of age, came wisdom. I finally smartened up. I got the smart. I said, my family love me. And if you tell them, they will probably be hurt, but they love me. And it is not going to make them love me any less. So go ahead and tell them if you want to. So all of a sudden that was taken from her. That was her club that she had dangling over my head for 3 years. More so for the previous year. She didn't threaten me prior to that, really. You know, I guess she wasn't as jealous then, but I'd say in the previous year, that's when she decided that she needed this thing to hold over me. And I decided that, hey, you know, I don't have to give in to you for anything, and I don't have to do anything I don't want to do. And if you find it necessary to tell my parents, then I really, really feel sorry for you that you find it necessary. So, be my guest. I went off to the Air Force, and when I came back from St. John on my way through to Clinton, Ontario, I had about a 3-hour wait for the train, the connecting train in Toronto. So I decided to phone her. I phoned a few people that I knew, and so anyway, I phoned Terry's number. Well, Terry went up one side of me and down the other to say that she said that Ruth was in 999 Queen Street, the mental hospital institution, and that it was all my fault. This was somewhat of a surprise to me. My fault? Yep. You left her, and she just couldn't take it. She was talking about committing suicide. I said, yeah, probably when she was drinking lots. Anyway, I guess she got carried away one night, and somebody found it necessary to take her down there and lock her up, and maybe for her own protection. I have no idea. I felt bad about it, but I kept trying to think, was this really your fault? And I thought, no, it couldn't be. So my first leave that I had from there was from Clinton. I went to one of my friends were leaving. Was going to Toronto and was on the same leave, like a weekend pass. So I asked for a ride to Toronto, and I went to Toronto, and I went down to 999 Queen Street. And I went in there. And when I went in there, it brought to mind one night Ruth and I watching TV, and we saw a movie called The Snake Pit. I believe Olivia de Havilland. And it was about a mental institution. And I walked in there and I thought, my God, this is the snake pit. This is it in real life. All kinds of people with vacant looks in their faces and whatnot. And I was finally led to where Ruth was, and she was in a ward. Like, God, there must have been 20 beds in there. It's a long ward. And I went and I sat down beside her, and she knew me and whatnot, but she seemed to be drugged or something. I thought, oh my God. So I went back to Clinton, and the next time I got a leave, I came back to see her, and I went there. And she wasn't there. They had transferred her next door to Women's College Hospital at 2 Surrey Place. That's all it was called, was 2 Surrey Place. I remember these things like it was yesterday, and it was yet so long ago. My God, almost 40 years ago. But I went to 2 Surrey Place, and I went in there. I got off the elevator, and immediately I was almost pushed back into the elevator by the staff, because I had my uniform on, and these people, if they saw a uniform, they would think it's the police, and you know. So I wasn't pushed back, but they, you know, a couple of staff members came rushing toward me and asked me where I was going and what I wanted to do. And, you know, one of them ran with a lab coat and put a lab coat on me. I had to take my jacket off and had to take my tie off and, you know, try and loosen as much and have the, and wear this lab coat. It's all right for me to wear a lab coat, but not this authoritarian, I guess, uniform that could be misconstrued as a police uniform. So I went to see her, and then I think she was even more vacant. I don't know. Then she was in a room by herself. And I didn't get a hell of a lot of conversation from her. And so they informed me that her mother was there from Nova Scotia. I said, where? Well, she's here in Toronto. She's, you know, staying here somewhere. So I phoned this Terry. And yes, Ruth's mother was there. She had been told that her daughter was in the hospital, so she came up by train from Nova Scotia. So I went to see her the next day. And she asked me, and I mean, she loved me like she was a mother, you know, like I was her daughter. And she said, did Ruth ever tell you that she, I forget how she put it, but more or less, she was asking, did Ruth ever tell me how she felt about me, that she felt like, you know, she said, like you'd be together, like your mom and dad are together. And I didn't know what Ruth had said, and I didn't know what, I did recognize that this information may have hurt her mom more than she was already hurt. So I said, I don't think so. It was the best answer I could come up with. I couldn't clarify it for her. Because, like I said, I didn't know what Ruth said, and I didn't know what condition Ruth was in when she said it, but I did see that the woman was hurting. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was information that she'd been threatening to tell my parents. And so so I just left it at that. And her mother was satisfied with that. And I went back to Clinton, and after that I was sent out to Edgar, Ontario. And from there I went to Beaverbank, Nova Scotia. And that was in like 1961 that I went to Beaverbank, Nova Scotia. And that was the first time that Ruth ever surfaced again. And she did surface there. And that was not a pretty time. So, that gets me into the Air Force. And when I was in the Air Force, there were things that happened with three women who were in Clinton, who were kicked out because they were suspected to be lesbians. And the female officer stood up there, like she called us all together and vowed to us that if we wanted to be kicked out of the RCAF, then all we had to do was tell them that we're homosexuals. So that sort of put the fear of God into everybody. Although, you know, when I joined the Air Force, I made a vow to myself that if any woman ever gives me a second look, you know, in that way, quote unquote, that way, that I would... I would probably just give a piece of my mind. because I didn't want to have to anything, like, you know, this was not a nice experience. And so I guess I just wanted to be a normal person, because I thought that I hadn't been normal for the last 3 years. And so now here was this officer standing there saying that she's kicking these three women out because they're suspected of being homosexuals. And I thought, see, that's what happens. Yeah. And and yet I had this affinity for, you know, I knew these people, these three women who were being kicked out, and you know, I felt sorry for them, and I knew that they seemed to be like me, you know, like I was. I didn't have any desires toward them, but I found that I was attracted to the butcher type of airwoman. Those were the friends that I found myself making. And I felt that they were all gay, but as long as none of them approached me, that's fine. Just don't touch me in that way.
It's now the 24th of November, and the last time we were talking, you had just finished telling me about the day that those three women got thrown out of the Air Force, and you were talking about how you sort of socialized, you seemed to be attracted to a more butchier kind of airwoman, but you were very clear that they weren't to, you know, you weren't going to tolerate any advances or anything like that. And I was wondering, during those Air Force years, if you knew which of the women were lesbians and which were not.
I assumed, and I assumed correctly. Like once I got to know them, but my first year or so, I just sort of swore off women, and but yes, I hung around with the ones that, to me, it's sort of, you know, it takes one to know one, but I didn't realize that at that time. I was just attracted to them in a way that I just felt we had something in common. I wanted to be their friends. I would feel more comfortable with them than I did with any of my other friends or acquaintances, I should say, who were always tittering about their boyfriends and that type of thing. Like, it just didn't interest me. It's like going to a Tupperware party. It's not my thing. So there we go.
Now, you weren't calling yourself gay in that period, were you?
No, I didn't know gay. Because of my 3 years with Ruth, and I thought we were the only ones, and then when I found out that there were other people, other women like that, I mean, I had no idea that men were also attracted to men. That was, you know, that came as a bit of a shock to me. And yeah, that's all I have to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was it after those women got thrown out that you nearly ended up marrying that guy?
Yes.
That was after.
Yeah. Because I'd only been three or 4 months in the Air Force in St. Jean, Quebec, and then I went to Clinton, Ontario. And it was in Clinton, and I was there maybe a month. So I was in somewhere between 4 and 6 months in the Air Force, and I was just I guess for all intents and purposes, I was asexual. I wasn't interested in males or females. I was interested in what I thought was going to be my career for the rest of my life type thing. And so, yes, it was definitely after. It was when I went to what they called out in the field. When I went to a permanent station after I had my trade training, I was then stationed to a place, and I would be there for more than a year, and it was there at that place that I met him, and we sort of clicked as friends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there was a deciding moment for you, wasn't there, in the restaurant?
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, when we went to a restaurant and a very nice-looking woman came in, and she sat across from us, and she just kept looking over every now and then, you know. We'd sort of exchange glances, but Jack exchanged glances with her as well, so I don't know what it was. Maybe she was just looking at us as a nice young couple. Who knows what thoughts were going on in her head. But when she got up and walked out, and we were sitting by the window, Jack remarked, "What a beautiful looking woman. What an attractive woman." And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking the same thing. All of a sudden the light went on. I thought, for God's sake, I'm fighting this, I'm fighting it, I'm fighting it. And at that point I've got several friends who are gay, several lesbian friends, and I didn't discuss it with them, but I knew that they were. So anyway, it was then that I decided that I needed to do something about it.
Right.
And at that point, did your social scene change? I mean, did you become more involved with the lesbians in the force, or
no? I was still very much closeted because I didn't tell Jack why I was on radar station, and a radar station, there was 150 to 200 people, and we were a close-knit community. So the people who were on your crew, those were the people, because you worked with them, but you shared the same days off. So the people who were on the other crews, there was three crews, which kept the radar bases going 24 hours a day. There were always two crews working, and one crew was off. We worked on three-day shifts, so three, three, and three. So if you were going to do any kind of socializing, it generally happened on the base, and it generally happened with the people who were on your crew. Whether they were married, men and women, or if they were people, you know, the guys who lived in the barracks or the women who lived in the barracks, whatever. They were all your friends. So there wasn't a sort of, what should I say, a clique. Or a group of lesbians. So for the longest time at my first station, the station where Jack was, I knew that some of them were, but there weren't that many of them. And so that was never ever spoken about, and I didn't ever pursue anybody. And just led a life of just having parties, you know, being part of the parties all the time. And it wasn't until I left that station and went to Beaverbank, Nova Scotia, and there I met Lorraine. And it was there that, at Edgar, I was on a ball team. I was the captain of the ball team. softball team. But when I went to Beaverbank, Nova Scotia, I was also on the ball team, but it ended up that the ball team there was probably 90% lesbian. And then it came out, you know. And I wasn't interested in anybody, but, you know, I went with Lorraine and with some other women, and we would go down to Halifax, because this station was in Nova Scotia, north of Halifax. We'd go into Halifax, and we would go to an area of Halifax called Africville, which you probably have heard about. It's black. Because one of these women had a girlfriend down there. And and that's where we would go, and we'd sit up and drink all night long, and you know, you'd go in with a 2-4 of beer and have it underneath your chair, and you'd play cards all night, and it was the first time I ever heard a song by Jackie Wilson called My Woman, My Lover, My Friend. Needless to say, I danced to it. And can you believe it? That sometime over the past, let's say, 10 years, I was in a record shop, or in a place. Anyway, they had this clearance on records, and I found a Jackie Wilson LP that has My Woman, My Lover, My Friend on it. Taped it and sent it off to Lorraine. Because she was the woman I danced with. Mm. The first time I ever heard that song. And we played it over and over and over again. So,
What year would that have been?
That would have been 1961. '61, '62 would be the latter part of '61 and maybe the early part of '62. Mm. But the ball team there, as I said, were probably 90% gay. And we had a place we called the Rendezvous. And being a ball team, and being in a place like near Halifax, Nova Scotia, we entertained the Navy women. And they also had Army stationed there as well in Halifax. So from Halifax, like, if we were going to have the Navy girls come and play ball against us on our station, all the Army girls came with them to support them.
It was like fun.
And if we went into Halifax to play ball against the Army, the Navy came to support us, and vice versa. We're always supporting one another. It usually seemed that you supported, you never supported the home team.
Mm.
Okay, so if the Army were hosting us, the Navy supported us. And at this rendezvous, it was like a farmer's open field, but there was a facade of trees in front of it. So, you know, you could drive in. You had to know exactly where to drive in, and you would drive in, and then you had this great big open field. And so after the ball game was over, we'd all go there because we could drink and make out and do whatever. You know, and a lot of fights took place there. Mm-hmm. A lot of fights. I couldn't believe that women fought over one another so much. I just thought, hey, no wonder I don't want to be part of this. God, you know, all the jealousies and all of that stuff.
So yeah. How many women would be in this spot at one time?
At one time, there could be 50, 60 of us.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, yeah, and, but The Air Force Police, they knew that we were going somewhere.
Mm.
And so finally, I guess they followed us one night when they saw the whole lot of us going, Army, Navy, and Air Force. And they must have just hopped in somebody's car, like a private car, and just sort of joined the caravan. And but they didn't come in right away. They went and they got the RCMP because they didn't have jurisdiction outside of the base.
Mm.
So they got the RCMP, and all of a sudden we were more or less surrounded by RCMP. And it was every woman for them. they couldn't arrest us because, you know, as soon as somebody screamed that the police were here, I mean, any booze or anything was just, it was gone. So, anyway, there was nothing that they could do because there was nothing that they could prove. But it was shortly after that, very shortly after that, that Lorraine, and she was with Joan at the time, and there were seven of us from the ball team who were called, we were put under house arrest and sent off to Montreal, to St. Hubert, Quebec, to be interviewed by psychiatrists who were trying to help us with our sickness. And it was in a great deal, it was related to Armenians at the rendezvous, because they figured that we were just going there to sit and talk about boyfriends. They figured something else was going on there. Lots of unnatural things were happening.